So here's the setup for this scene. Lawmakers are gathered in session at the Capitol. Things are tense because the atmosphere has been volatile. There have been protests. Legislators have been threatened. But they're there at work when they hear some commotion just outside. It's a mob trying to break down the doors. Only here's the twist. This isn't last week in Washington. This is the scene that played out last summer, August 24th, at the Idaho Capitol building in Boise. And the mob wasn't protesting election fraud. This was about masks. The journalist Michael Ames wrote about it in The New Yorker.
Somewhere around 200 people showed up for the start of the Idaho legislator special session that had been called by the governor to deal with a couple of bills around coronavirus issues. And because they don't believe that the coronavirus is either real or as severe as they're being told, or regardless of how severe they look at it, they don't believe it justifies the amount of government actions and mandates, they wanted to get in there and participate and have their voices heard. And then, of course, the sort of perfect foil to them was the fact that the viewing gallery in the House chamber that day had been reserved due to coronavirus restrictions. When they heard that, that fact lit the fuse of their anger. It turned into a mob mentality that led to a very small and contained riot by comparisons of what we just saw. But at the time in August, I thought it was quite astounding and a line had been crossed.
We should point out, as you do in the piece, that there was a kind of performative element to it that we also saw last week at the Capitol. It was playing out on Facebook Live. I'm sure there were plenty of selfies and posts, and it's like a performance in some ways for these guys.
It's an interesting way of thinking about it.
But now is not like always, is it? That's why you're having a special get-together.
They don't want to do what's right. That's why.
If you don't want to hear the truth, then I'm sorry.
Have a testimony and I want to give it.
I
have a testimony and I want to give it.
You work for us.
Yeah.
Knock it off.
I think once they realized that there were rules that could be tested, even if that ended up with their arrest, it looks very much like, and I had Idaho House Speaker Scott Bedke even said this to me on the record, that he believed their purpose was to be arrested. They see it as an act of civil disobedience.
A glass pane of one of the doors broke. Were they armed, and was this dangerous?
They were armed in a way that most Idaho lawmakers are accustomed to having constituents arrive armed. It's not unusual in an open carry state in the open carry capital to see armed constituents, and legislators told me that that's not uncommon. But when you combine that level of concealed carry or even open carry with now a mob that is chanting, "Let us in, let us in," and now physically engaging with Idaho State Police to the point that the glass pain broke quite loudly and dramatically, that really set some lawmakers on edge and led one of them, a Republican whose name I was not told, but to walk by another one of the sources for the story and say, "It was a bad day to forget my gun."
One lawmaker you mentioned in the piece, you profile, Mariana Davis, member of the legislature, former Paralympic medalist. She's a Democrat in a conservative state, gets elected in that, I guess, that wave of Democratic victories in the midterm elections of 2018. Talk about how she's reacting to what's happening.
Right. She was a well-known figure in Southern Idaho as a multi-medalist in several Paralympic games. There's a trail named after her at the Sun Valley Resort. She's, you know, was a minor celebrity even before she was elected. And she found herself in this small uprising in a wheelchair. And she realized that in her wheelchair, there was not a very easy exit. And she was going to have to go right through this line of cops and protesters, she felt that she was in danger. And when she eventually made it to her car, she said she started to shake uncontrollably and was truly rattled by what she had seen. People like her get involved in politics because they believe in the capacity and potential of our system, our American system, to impose order on chaos. And of course, what we have been seeing since what happened in Boise in August and last week in Washington is that right now, chaos is making a pretty strong play for the dominant system at the moment.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Leading the protest that day was Ammon Bundy. He's the son of the rancher Cliven Bundy, whose refusal to pay his grazing fees ignited an armed showdown with federal officials back in 2014. Ammon Bundy has been caught up in these kinds of protests throughout the West. A day after that mob stormed the Idaho Capitol, Bundy was arrested at an auditorium there. He tied himself to a rolling chair, refused to budge. The police had to roll him out of the building. Now, to be clear, Ammon Bundy was not in Washington last week. He hasn't said anything publicly about whether he supported the armed insurrection there. But it's hard not to make a connection to the actions he has supported in the West, protests over land and, in the case last summer, over COVID mask mandates and business restrictions. And we wanted to explore whether the violence in Washington last week could be traced back to the West, at least in part. We spoke this week with Eric Molvar of the environmental group The Western Watersheds Project, who said what happened last week is the direct result of a growing movement in the West. He said there had been this systematic failure by law enforcement to deal with the actions at the Bundy Ranch, at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, and other places that has basically, he said, emboldened this movement. Michael Ames' New Yorker article is called How Ammon Bundy Helped Foment an Anti-Masker Rebellion in Idaho, and we're going to start there. Because Ames told us this pandemic has driven a wedge between the mainline Republicans in the West and the more radical libertarian types, like Ammon Bundy.
I spoke to several of those establishment Republicans, and it was very interesting to speak with them because they don't have a lot of kind words for people who they see as activists on their own side. And the real political action and friction is between these two elements in the Republican Party. But your more moderate, more establishment Republicans are willing to listen to public health experts, willing to listen to scientists, and do what they can to make people safer, lower the number of deaths, and basically show that government can work to make people's lives better. And what they're up against is a faction of their own party that refuses to accept that government can do anything to not only to limit the impacts of the virus, but that government can even be trusted with speaking facts about what's going on.
Well, that gets us to Ammon Bundy. Tell us, when does Ammon Bundy come into this picture? And maybe, first of all, we should explain who he is. We've talked about the Bundys on this program before, but just remind listeners who this figure is, Ammon Bundy.
Well, Ammon is the son of Cliven Bundy, who your listeners may have heard about since 2014, when there was the first major standoff with his family at their ranch in the Mojave Desert on the Arizona-Nevada border. And that was over unpaid grazing fees. And people came in from around the West, including from Haley, Idaho, to face off with federal agents. And it was looking like a reprise of things we may have remembered from the early 90s in Northern Idaho or in Texas with federal agents and conservative elements. But unlike in the 90s, the federal agents pulled back and no shots were fired and no one was killed. 2 years later, perhaps motivated by that, but in his telling, I think he had something of a divine epiphany that he was needed as an activist to protect the interests of another ranching family in eastern Oregon who was being brought up on a cycle of charges from the feds about fines they had not paid relating to fires they had set to on their own land management in a very remote part of rural Oregon, which led in turn to the 2016 Malheur Wildlife refuge occupation when Ammon Bundy led a couple dozen of his cohort to take over by force and occupy a government compound of buildings in a wildlife preserve.
And we'll come back to this, but because there's a theme here in terms of the way the federal government has reacted, they also, it's not fair to say they stood down because several were arrested, but they allowed federal authorities, allowed this to play out for that 6 weeks or a number of weeks.
Yeah. And I mean, it was extremely cold. It was January in the Eastern Oregon high desert, but that did end with a man dead and some skirmishes. And several charges for a lot of people involved, but Bundy himself was acquitted on all those charges.
Yeah.
And he was relatively quiet. And then when this pandemic started, I think it presented both something that he was genuinely infuriated by and skeptical about, but also an opportunity. And he, along with many on the right in Idaho, in that harder right we were talking about, especially evident with the Idaho Freedom Foundation, saw a political opportunity here with the pandemic. And nearly as soon as the pandemic started and Governor Little put forth some mandates and rules and law changes last March and April, you saw Bundy uniting with different harder libertarian elements, conservative policy groups to use it as an opportunity.
The rhetoric Bundy is using is pretty provocative. What were some of the demonstrations that he led? Because you point out in the piece, they just got more and more aggressive. They seemed really intense. This resistance about mask mandates and business shutdowns.
I think what I was glad to cover in this story, and what I think needs to be understood, is the degree of political organization going on through the Idaho Freedom Foundation. It's worth just stopping a moment to talk about that foundation. It is we could call it a libertarian think tank, but it is registered as a 501c3 tax exempt charity, despite doing what looks by all appearances as quite obvious political lobbying. It also should be mentioned that as their protests were greatly eclipsed in size and scope by protests on the left after the George Floyd murder, I think there started to be a bit of a seesaw of escalation. You know, so you have a couple thousand people maybe show up to an initial right-wing anti-government protest in April, and then you have many, many more thousands to show up in early July to march through the streets of Boise to protest what happened to George Floyd and on behalf of Black Lives Matter. And then a couple weeks after that, you see Bundy and some of his people go into a health district meeting and break in and cross the physical line from civil disobedience to active, let's call it, kinetic measure protests.
I want to get to his ideology, his philosophy, his point of view. So you've talked to him. How does he seem? What's he like? What's it like talking to Ammon Bundy?
Ammon Bundy seems extremely sincere in his beliefs. I mean, I've been a political and government reporter for over a decade and spoken to a lot of, spin masters and political operatives. And I like to think I have some ability to tell when someone is sharing their truly held beliefs versus something they're being paid to say. And while I think Ammon Bundy may be opportunistic and a skilled media player, I also think he's sincere in his beliefs and in his fear about government overreach. I don't think he's chosen the wisest battle in fighting against mask mandates specifically, but in talking to him, I got the sense of someone who feels that government power is too often unchecked, and that there are ways for average people to protest and stand up and peacefully make their voices heard.
He doesn't dispute. This is interesting. You say in the piece he doesn't dispute the fact that the coronavirus is, in fact, contagious. He doesn't dispute the fact that, in fact, people are dying from COVID-19. He just resists this idea of the power of the state, these mandates. That's the thing that he's pushing against, I guess.
Correct. He's extremely consistent, and maybe to a fault in this case, because he just sees any government mandate and any government rule as onerous and unjustified. And when it comes to telling people that they have to stay in their homes or put a mask on, he doesn't see, you know, and I live in New York now, and I told him, I said, what I saw here happen last spring was truly dramatic with the impact of the coronavirus. And who knows, maybe if he lived in a place where there were more trucks on the street, maybe he'd feel differently. Maybe it was the slow onset in Idaho and in the Intermountain West that made him think it was overblown. Certainly he's not alone among people who think that the threat of the virus is overblown. I think those of us who lived in large cities understand what can happen when a hospital system is overwhelmed. But from his perspective, he just saw it as one of many opportunities that the government could take to enlarge, expand its own power, its own reach in ways that he fears will never be pulled back. But he's very consistent, and we should talk about how that consistency plays into his support even for Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, say something about that, because that is something, one of the things you point out in the piece is that his philosophy defies an easy characterization. He has, as you point out in the piece, he rebuked President Trump's anti-immigration policies. He's distanced himself from right-wing militias. And as you said, voiced support for Black Lives Matter, which I have to say really took me aback. I hadn't expected that, because he even said, you mentioned in your piece, he believed that the police do need to be defunded.
Yeah, and I think his consistency is probably one of his strengths as a political organizer. He sees what happens to Black people and minorities being oppressed and mistreated by law enforcement as very much the same as people he knew when he was younger, ranchers being, as he saw it, oppressed by government rules and mandates. And just to take away the value judgments here, we don't have to say or the degree to which he may be correct, or by comparison, right? Perhaps I think we'd be able to say the shooting of unarmed Black citizens is a greater form of oppression than fines being compounded for unpaid grazing fees. That said, there is a consistency, an undeniable consistency, in his belief that both are instances of government overreach.
Where does Edmund Bundy center his ideas about government and freedom? Is this something that he finds in his Mormon faith?
I believe there is a merging of his faith and a sort of divine constitutionalism, that he sees the Constitution as a God-given document. And these rights are therefore not just grounded in law, but in divine law. And that sort of bolsters, undergirds what he says and believes with a true fervor. And that's why I said when I spoke to him, he struck me as truly sincere.
Does he talk a lot about God, or does he talk a lot about Mormonism? Like, does he mention, for example, I don't know, scriptures from the Book of Mormon as citations to justify what he's doing? I mean, how full of religious rhetoric is the way he talks?
No, he never got that specific with me. He never cited any specific scripture. He more cites the broad brush, the principles, the tenets of this philosophy, that the government, you know, he would say, a common phrase he would say is, by what law of God or man does the government think they have this right? You know, it's not in the Constitution, so that is a law of man, and it is not in any religious order, so by what rule of God? And since the Constitution is a sort of quasi-divine article anyway, there's a certain overlap there. He believes that the government has great capacity for evil. He believes that the 20th century and examples of what happened in oppressive totalitarian regimes bears him out. And he has, I think what's disappointing is that he has little faith in the American system to pull back from those extremes. It would be great, I think, if in his involvement with these issues, he sort of got into the nitty-gritty and saw that government is trying to do its best for people. And I would hope that one day he could sit down with people in government and sort of try to understand one another, because I don't think his goals are malicious. I don't think his visions are malevolent. I think he wants peaceful outcomes and he wants justice. He's just doing it from a position of fervently held extreme beliefs. And at this point, and I think we should talk about a rather capable political organizing system that he has set up.
Say more about that. Talk about the system. He's a good organizer. I mean, I think people weren't expecting that from someone they perceive as just being this sort of one-dimensional extremist.
Absolutely. I think I hear from people who say, don't keep talking about this radical. He's an extremist and we shouldn't talk about him. And I think that's ignoring the reality of the situation. He's a fervent believer in his cause and he's not going away. And he has set up something called the People's Rights Network. And people can go look that up on the internet and you can see how well set up it is and how people can sign up to become involved with that network in whatever state and region of the state that you're in. It's in, they're trying to set it up in all 50 states. And as far as community organizing goes from a digital platform, it's quite good. It's quite sophisticated. It may not be the same level of intricacy that turns out get out the vote operations for the Democratic National Committee or, you know, the Republican Senatorial Committee. But it's growing quickly, and I think it has real capacity for good or for chaotic outcomes. I mean, we saw what happened in Boise when people involved in that network protested at the home of Ada County Health Board commissioners, and it turned chaotic pretty quickly.
I wanted to ask you, Michael, what characteristics that we saw last week in Washington may have come from or the parts of them anyway may have come from the West. And some of the reporting about that, including NPR, suggested those who monitor these extreme groups say that what happened last week at the U.S. Capitol was something that had been, as NPR put it, incubating in the West, the Western United States for years. Kirk Siegler of NPR reported that some believe people should have seen this coming. He quoted Eric Ward, this person from the Western State Center, who said that there are these warning signs that you had Trump loyalists who were emboldened after watching these moments in the West. Malheur is one you mentioned before. And I'm wondering, are you seeing a connection there?
Well, there's certainly a connection. I think Ammon Bundy put out a video with other leaders in his People's Rights Network to encourage people to go to D.C. Now, I watched his statement, and there was no mention of fighting or bringing a gun or any kind of physical intimidation in Bundy's statement. So I don't know how much we can connect. You know, there's a temptation to say that all anti-government protesters are one and the same, and I don't think that's the case. I think what we saw in Washington was a gigantic convergence of an awful lot of different demographics. I think the common thread is a big lie. There is the big lie that Donald Trump actually won an election, which we all know and courts have confirmed ad nauseum that he in fact lost. And I think in terms of tying it to what the story I wrote about and what we were talking about earlier is that there's also a big lie in telling people that the virus is not really risky and the virus is, and that masks don't do anything. Those are lies. And when people who are upset and frustrated for understandable reasons are misinformed with lies, that's a really dangerous cocktail.
It's Michael Ames. He's a political and environmental reporter, co-author of the book American Cipher. You can find a link to his New Yorker article about Ammon Bundy on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Tuesday marks the start of the Utah legislative session. I'm Sonia Hudson.
I'm Emily Means. And we're the hosts of KUER's weekly politics podcast, 45 Days. In our first episode of the year, we're answering questions about how to govern during a public health crisis, and we have a sneak peek of what to expect in the session.
That's this week's 45 Days from KUER News. Subscribe for free wherever you listen to podcasts, or just go to 45days.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about whether a growing movement of protests here in the West over land, now over mask mandates, has fueled, at least in part, the mob violence in Washington last week. And we've been interested in one family in particular, the Bundy family, led by the rancher Cliven Bundy, because they've played this important role in some of the armed occupations and standoffs in this region over the last several years. The Bundys are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which interested us because they draw some of their ideas about liberty and resistance from the Mormon experience. We talked this week to Betsy Quammen. She's a writer and historian based in Bozeman, Montana, and she's been following this story. She has a new book called American Zion, Cliven Bundy, God, and Public Lands in the West. Make the connection for us. Will you? Between that mob riot last week at the Capitol and some of the standoffs and occupations that we've been seeing in the West over the last few years, what's the connection you're seeing?
I think the West has this history of rebellion. We've seen it with the Sagebrush Rebellion. This has been a powerful movement that's been very anti-government and very much pro-states' rights. And there is this feeling of fierce independence and don't tread on me liberty that comes from the West. Now, it's not just the West, but I think it's really, really ingrained here. And I think that what we've seen is that with the Malheur event and with the Battle of Bunkerville and with some of this anti-mask agitating that's really been quite powerful here. I mean, I'm seeing it in my hometown too, in Montana. I do believe that there's a certain momentum that the West carries into events like we're seeing in DC. And I'm afraid that we're going to continue to see it.
So the Bundy family is Mormon. So let's talk about the Mormon connection. And I think before we do, let's clarify something that you do. You write about this in the book, for example. You mention how the Bundy family's position are not really teachings that you'll find in modern mainstream Mormonism. As you say in the book, the LDS Church has publicly condemned the Bundys' claims that, you know, their beef against the government is some way justified by Mormon scripture. You've also pointed out that Ammon Bundy's anti-mask efforts are not supported by LDS Church officials. You've pointed out the church's implemented some pretty strict social distancing measures. You know, they've shut down services for a time. So it seems like there is – Bundy is Mormon. He draws these ideas from Mormonism for sure, but it seems like there's a difference between sort of the mainstream modern thinking and what he's drawing on, which seems like, I don't know, older thinking in Mormonism. Am I right about that?
Yes, the Bundy family, I think, is motivated by their faith. And the Mormon Church has come out very clearly saying that they do not abide by the Bundy's actions. They did it at Malheur when Ryan and Ammon made the point that it was their Mormon faith that really motivated their actions in Malheur in Oregon. What I have seen in terms of the Bundys' religious motivations, is that it does go back to early church ideas and theology. And it also, these ideas have been echoed by various prophets over the years, in particular Ezra Taft Benson. Mm-hmm. And it's this idea that the Mormon people need to protect the Constitution when it's, quote unquote, hanging by a thread. And the Constitution in the Mormon culture is considered sacred. And this, again, it's viewed differently by different people within the church.
Yeah.
But the Bundy family would say that the Constitution is sacred. Therefore, it's incumbent upon us to protect the Constitution. This is our role. It's our religious duty to do so. And I really think that comes into play in what we're seeing the family do.
In the book, you say the Bundys have, this is how you put it, you say they've employed a unique syncretism that blends the legend of the cowboy with early Mormon beliefs. It's kind of a mashup of those kind of myths, maybe, it could be said.
Absolutely. And I think that really is truly the case, that there is this deep sense in Cliven. His cowboy identity is very, very important to him, as well as his Mormon faith. And it's something that I also saw when I visited some of their neighbors, that this idea of being a cowboy and a Mormon cowboy is really important. It goes back generation after generation after generation. And their lifestyle, I think, becomes both a tribute to their faith, but also a tribute to their ancestry.
Yeah.
And when I had a conversation with the family, you know, we talked about the first Mormon ancestors that came to this area and how important that was in terms of his identity, but also in terms of validating his fight against the government, that he had this history of Mormon cowboys, and he had descended from Mormon cowboys, and here he was defending that identity and what he construed was his right.
I'm interested in your visit to the Bundy spread, but let me ask you broadly before we get to your visit with them, because you talk about that in your book. What interests you about this just in general? You've written that the Bundys and the sort of Mormon strain that they draw from interests you because of their position against the government, their engagement with these militia groups. What is it that is interesting to you about this?
I am very interested in how religious views impact the way that we see landscape. And I feel like there's a very Mormon way of viewing landscape. And when I went to talk to the family, I was actually working on my dissertation, and I was looking at how the ideas in Mormon settlement, how they inform the way landscape is perceived and the way landscape is utilized. So when I went to talk to them, I really went to talk to them about their faith. I did not talk to them about the standoff. I did not talk to them about anti-government agitating. I really wanted to know what it was within their Mormon worldview that informed their position on land.
And they were really great, right? I mean, they seemed really nice and pleasant and inviting. Gave you a Book of Mormon, I think.
Yes, that when I went to visit the Bundy family, they were very nice to me. They spent quite a bit of time talking to me, answering my questions. They really were. I was very grateful. I in my acknowledgments, I thanked the family. They really were interested in putting forth their views. They wanted to talk about why this was so important to them and why they were engaged in this fight. And at the time I visited them, it was a year after the Battle of Bunkerville, and it was a year before Malheur. And when I visited them, I really thought that they were an outlier in terms of a group of people who were ready to go up against the government in armed rebellion because of their faith. Mm-hmm. And I've realized that I was completely wrong. From the time I visited him to now, their influence has really permeated Western culture, and I think we could even argue national culture.
Okay, so in your book, you say that if we're really going to understand the rationale and the ideas of people like the Bundys, that you have to go back to the beginnings of the LDS Church, because you say this has a lot to say about rights and resistance. What is it in the early days of Mormonism? And this has to bring us to Joseph Smith and the kind of leader he was, his worldview that may inform it. What is it there that you're seeing? A sense of defiance, I guess, probably also a sense of defensiveness among early Mormons. They were pretty brutally persecuted, killed in many cases. What is it that you're seeing there that is informing, you know, Cliven Bundy and Ammon Bundy these days?
I went back and looked at the early Mormon church because I wanted to understand this culture. I did not know very much about Mormonism when I started working on this. And again, this was for my dissertation. So I found some of these threads to be really interesting in terms of explaining what we're seeing right now in the campaign that Cliven and Ammon and Ryan and his family have launched. There's an idea that D. Michael Quinn, who was a professor at BYU, a researcher, he talks about militant theology. Mm-hmm. And I found that term to be really interesting in terms of looking at what we're seeing now. The early church members were persecuted, and they were very peaceful until they started getting killed. And so there was an effort on the part of Joseph Smith to protect the Mormon people. And at a certain point, when they were in Nauvoo, Illinois, they had the second largest military body next to the U.S. Army. And when they came to the Great Basin or Utah Territory, at the time it was Mexican, they had these two very, very interesting sort of carryovers from when they had been in Missouri and in Illinois. And the two were an incredible anger at the U.S. government over the murder of Joseph Smith and real military training. They were prepared to defend themselves, and they hated the United States. Mm-hmm. And I know that the church today does not have the same relationship with the government or even this militant theology. But in understanding Mormonism, there's such an interest in history and historical content, you know, from letters from, you know, great grandparents to journals to even oral history is so important in the Mormon church that as a historian, I really do feel that this history is very much foundational to what the Bundys are doing today.
There's another element that I wanted to ask you about, and that is that something you write about, and others have talked about this as well, that in Mormon doctrine, the American Constitution is divinely inspired, which is kind of an understatement. I mean, in the sense that Joseph Smith, for example, you quote Joseph Smith in 1840, he said this. He warned that the nation will be on the verge of crumbling to pieces and tumbling to the ground when the Constitution is upon the brink of ruin. So this affection for seeing the Constitution as God's will, God's idea in some way, and then it being in jeopardy. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, because this is what Joseph Smith talked about, and this seems to inform some of these sort of Mormon extremists, it seems.
When I spoke to Cliven and asked him about the Constitution, understanding what an important role it plays in Mormon history. He said what you're saying. He said it's divinely inspired, which he said basically means that Jesus wrote the Constitution.
Wow.
And so you have a document that in some ways is every bit as sacred as every other text in the Mormon canon. And when people who have the same passion about the Constitution as the Bundy family have see that it's imperiled, they feel like it's a real call to arms. The other piece of that is that Joseph Smith encouraged a friendship between his brethren and the Constitution. There is a certain idea that the Mormon people have a better understanding of the Constitution, and therefore, when a constitutional scholar makes a point about the Constitution that they don't ascribe to, they have a better knowledge. And so when they see the Constitution kind of being ripped asunder, for example, perhaps when their cows were being confiscated, this becomes a religious act. It actually becomes a rite in standing up to the government, in armed insurrection. This is an extension of their faith.
Betsy Quammen. Her book is American Zion, Clive and Bundy, God and Public Lands in the West. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Using your smart speaker, starting your day with NPR Utah has never been easier. All you have to do is tell it to play KUER, and we'll be there throughout your morning with news and the latest Utah stories.
Now, the state of Utah has made an important move in this controversial issue. It's the first state in the country to protect.
That's KUER on your smart speaker. Just tell it to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The mob violence in Washington last week bears a striking resemblance to events that have played out in the West over the last few years. We're talking armed occupations and standoffs with federal authorities, all fueled by right-wing ideology, and much of it religious in nature. All of this talk of natural rights and the end of times. And we're exploring that connection this week. Back now to our conversation with the conservationist and historian Betsy Quammen. She has a new book called American Zion. I want to come back to something you were talking about earlier, and that is the kind of the Western part to this story. You say in your book that a map of the American West is a Rorschach test, and that people see what they want to see as reflections of who they are. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, that this Western identity and how the West may be playing a role in this agitation that's going on right now.
I think the West is a very unique, and I'm talking about the Intermountain West. I think it's very unique. And, you know, again, I'm in Montana. You all are in Utah, Arizona, New Mexico. I mean, every state has its own individual identity. But one thing that we all understand is this idea of open space and what goes with it, this idea of freedom, this idea of rugged individualism. One of the things that keeps coming up in my research and repeated, and of course you hear it from Ammon and Cliven, is this idea of liberty. And I think in the West, we have a real sense of personal liberty. It's different than living in big urban areas. We imagine ourselves to have a type of freedom that distinguishes Westerners. And again, it's mythological in some ways. It ties into the cowboy. I feel like there's also this idea that the West was one of the last places to be settled in the United States. So, you know, there's this, the colonial kind of conquering, you know, here we are, we as white people, because the West is primarily white, have a sense of entitlement that I think distinguishes us from other regions.
I want to ask you about a question that's being raised and has been raised since the riot last week, and that is that this violence in Washington was inspired in part by a failure of law enforcement to aggressively prosecute and respond to some of the illegal protests that were going on in the West. We spoke this week with Eric Molvar of the environmental group, the Western Watersheds Project, and I want to read something from their statement that they put out because I want to get your response to this. They wrote that the mob violence that swarmed the halls of the Capitol building in Washington is a direct result of a growing movement of domestic terrorists within the United States, paired with a systematic failure by law enforcement to bring them to justice. And here's the part that connects it, Betsy, to the West. The statement goes on. It says, this flows from a series of smaller armed insurrections by domestic terrorists in Bunkerville, at Malheur, and in Recapture Canyon in Utah and elsewhere across the West. What do you make of that idea that in part what's happening or has happened is because the feds have not been aggressive enough, and that's emboldened these people?
I think that's really true. I also think that we're seeing a strange issue with how to address domestic terrorism. I feel like the response at the Capitol last week was very much in line with what we expect when we see white people in rebellion. There's very little pushback. There's few consequences. I mean, that's not, you know, across the board, there were certainly people who went to jail after Malheur and the Battle of Bunkerville, but it was pretty minimal compared to what we would expect of a person of color. And I feel like white people think they can get away with it. I mean, you look at the people who were going into the Capitol. I mean, there was absolutely no fear of retribution when you look at these folks walking around. And so I think what we have right now on the part of law enforcement is a political fear. I think that they're afraid to confront white people. I think white people are more dangerous right now than black and brown people because they don't fear retribution and they have guns. And so you look at the Black Lives Matter protests and you don't see a bunch of armed people walking down the street unless you look over and see the counter protesters who are white armed people. And I'm sorry, I get really emotional about, I mean, it's so incredibly unfair. It's such a huge, huge problem in our country. And white armed people have scared law enforcement. And we saw it last week. You know, I mean, ever since Ruby Ridge, there have been a really angry group of white people at the government that have gotten more and more and more emboldened. And some of them actually really do want to get into a shootout with law enforcement. They want to, as they say all the time, we want to see another Waco. And another Waco has actually become more of a, like, remember the Alamo kind of motto. You know, Waco's very different than Ruby Ridge. But Ruby Ridge was a case of the government acting in an awful way. But the fact that white people, because of white supremacy, they haven't faced the consequences, but also because of real fear, just being scared of white people.
Well, it's because, you know, there was this question that some of us all had after last Wednesday. We, you know, once the mob broke into the Capitol, you know, like, what were they expecting would happen exactly once they got in there? Because, you know, they took selfies and they stole stuff and they vandalized property. They were violent, of course. But what exactly is the vision of what they wanted once they got there? And when you mention Waco, I'm guessing that may have been in some people's minds. But you also said you wonder if there's this strategy of occupation. What do you mean by that? Because it seems like there is some strategy there at stake, at hand, from some of these people.
It's really hard to say what they want because they have so many different motivations, ideologies, end games. And I think that you see people in the Capitol who were just there for the thrill of it. I think that you see people in the Capitol who just wanted to make their voices heard and to raise their ire with members of Congress. I think that there are people there who are really wanting to overthrow the government. There were people who really wanted to assassinate people. And I don't think that that's something. I mean, the Bundys weren't involved in the DC event. They weren't there.
I should also mention we don't exactly know what Ammon Bundy thinks about all of this, or for that matter, Cliven Bundy. Michael Ames, that we talked to earlier, was trying to contact Ammon Bundy, hadn't yet talked to him to get a sense of what he was thinking. So we shouldn't ascribe we shouldn't guess, I guess, at what they are thinking, because we don't know.
Well, yeah, I don't know what Ammon's thinking, and I don't think Ammon is a huge Donald Trump fan. He has not gotten into the Stop the Steal sort of campaign. He's really been focused on the anti-mask stuff. But Cliven has weighed in, and there were two things that Cliven indicated. Number one, he didn't particularly appreciate the fact that Donald Trump didn't march down there with them and support the quote unquote patriots that were breaking into the Capitol. And number two, he said that when the protesters got into the Capitol or occupy a building, that they should stay. And I think that that was the strategy at Malheur, you know, to occupy a federal property and stay. And I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, we're not by any stretch of the imagination through with these insurrections. I'm afraid we're going to continue to see it. But given that the strategy of occupying a property was already, you know, sort of seen in Oregon, I would not be surprised that another takeover or occupation happens.
Is the federal government paying attention to that, as far as you can tell? Are they making those connections? Are they noticing those things?
I hope so. I hope they're noticing. But given what we saw last week, the lack of response was jaw-dropping. And given that the focus on domestic terrorism has not been what it's needed to be by a long shot, I think we're going to really need to see the FBI and the federal government shift gears on this stuff, because domestic terrorism is a huge, huge threat to our country. And I think that everybody recognized that last week. And I hope that the Biden administration really starts to make that a top priority, or we're going to continue to see more empowerment and more emboldened actions.
Betsy Quammen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Betsy Quammen, she's a writer, environmental historian, and conservationist. Her new book is American Zion: Cliven Bundy, God, and Public Lands in the West. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.